we have free will or not. I think we were quarreling over it last evening. We have no free will, no choice at all. The discussion for no fault of anybody, any one of us, was pushed into us this morning. She was not here, and so she couldn't be blamed for starting it. We are literally pushed into it. Do we have a free will at all? Do we have a choice? The first part of this morning's discussion may be unorthodox. Then we'll come back to the orthodox. No. I has no free will, no choice. No freedom of choice. I has... The verb is important. I has no free will, no freedom of choice. Though I said this is unorthodox, there was at least one person who agreed with this, and that was Ramana Maharshi, who said you have no choice, but even not only to undergo the experiences allotted to you, which everybody agrees. We have no freedom to choose what sort of experiences we will have. That is the reaction to past karma we have. Over that we have no choice. Most metaphysicians, oriental metaphysicians, however, seem to think that you have a freedom of present action. Ramana Maharshi even went one step further and said, even that you do not have. You are conditioned so heavily by your own samskaras and vasanas, and even that is predetermined. But there is one choice, and that is which way you face. We'll come to that. So we have only one famous yogi or sage who supports us in this, that we have no freedom of will at all. What has freedom of will? Now, one more point in that connection before we proceed. We have no freedom of choice, that concept frightens most people, because then the whole thing is kept going unceasingly. I insult you, you hit me back, I hit you back, you hit me back, I hit you back, you hit me back, it just goes on. And since you are immortal, I am immortal, the battle also is immortal. Since neither of us has the freedom of choice or will to stop it, this goes on forever. Right. This was the problem that the orthodox metaphysicians faced. So unless you admit that there is a freedom of will and freedom of choice at some stage, this silly thing is not going to stop. The others of the Ramana Maharishi school of thought, they said, so what? A block of ice floats in a glass of whiskey. Why do you get excited? When rice cooks on the stove, it's boiling. But you don't have to boil. Is it right? Unless you foolishly identify yourself with that rice. The me again. It is the me that juggles you into a situation in which what is happening to this is assumed to be happening to me. The me that does not exist assumes that what is happening to the body and to the environment is happening to me. That is their theory. So let all these things go on, let this world go on eternally, unceasingly. Let all these earthquakes and volcanic eruptions and rain and storm and wars and pestilence, let these things go on. What have you to do with all that? What has this infinite consciousness, what has that to do? Does it Is it ever affected by all this? The infinite consciousness is not affected, but the me is affected. And since these people, these no choice free, no free will, no choice people, deny the very existence of the me, there is no problem for them. We'll come back to that later on, next week. Is there free will and is there a freedom of choice or not? Yes, there is freedom of choice. But to whom? To this. To that consciousness deep within. That being the sole consciousness. The sole reality. It is that reality that has thrown up a thing called Rick. I call it Rick. His mother called it. Sorry to say, called it. So far as the infinite consciousness is concerned, you are it. That infinite consciousness which threw up a thing called earth, which threw up a thing called thing which you call earth, which you call water, that has freedom of choice. That being the desirer of everything, that being the doer of everything, that being the experiencer of everything, that has absolute freedom of choice, total freedom of choice, total freedom of action, total freedom, not bound by anything. Is there a free will? That has free will, not I. I has no free will. I is here. The me is here, the deep chasm, and the I is somewhere there. That has no freedom of choice at all. One thing more we suggested yesterday, that when the personality condenses, as it were, the spiral condenses, as it were, tornado forms, there is the pressure lightens around it, right? This is a sort of vacuum, not quite a complete vacuum. There is a thinning of the atmosphere around it. So that this consciousness, though it is infinite, energy though it is infinite, when the personality is formed, there is a thinning of that light around it. In a manner of speaking, these are all words. Don't get hung up on words. Try to see it. When this infinite consciousness, which is everywhere, like air which is everywhere, when it condenses into your personality, the density in the personality increases, as it were, and the field of perception, the field of transparency around it weakens. Therefore, this personality is unable to perceive something beyond, and therefore the me is formed. A sort of conditioned vision, limited vision gets formed. The personality is unable to look beyond this me. Because that consciousness and that energy has somehow condensed, become so, the density here is increased, becomes a mass of flesh and blood and bone and stuff and nonsense. And since this has become condensed like the tornado, there is, as it were, an absence of light around. Perhaps one little example might help, but please use it only for a limited purpose. If we are sitting in during twilight, the evening, there is light outside, there is light inside. Suddenly, lit up the whole room, the flood lamps, you won't be able to see outside. There's so much of light inside that the outside is dark. The outside is not dark. When you walk out of this place and stand at the threshold for a couple of minutes, then you are able to see and you can walk in that dim light also. The light becomes dim outside because of the excess of light in the room. Vaguely similarly, because there is a condensation of the cosmic material to form this personality, around it the light becomes dim, and that is what you call me. You cannot see beyond that, and therefore all this is me. And when this me starts playing in this world, it plays this game. Throw a ball, hit it, and it goes right round, spiral action, comes and hits you back. It's one of those nasty things with this karma. You do something, you know, it leaves in front of you. And the reaction usually comes back and hits you from behind when you least expect it. Yes? The reaction always seems to come when you least expect it, and perhaps when you are least able to deal with it. When we are young, we do all sorts of crazy things. Smoke, drink, and do funny. And nothing seems to happen. And you say, "Maha, nonsense, this karma is no karma. Go on, go ahead." And then, when you are 50, 60, it comes back and hits you. You realize, "My God, liver problem. Oh, I used to drink. When I used to drink, it didn't bother me at all. And if at that time it had bothered me, I would have stopped drinking. I would have taken some remedy for it and, you know, got rid of it. Now, in my old age, silly thing, knowing that I am so weak, this silly thing hits me. And from behind, where you are unable to deal with it. That is this karma. And what is even worse, I don't know, you must have played with some of these games. There is a very modern game called some kind of tennis, they call it. Do you know what it is? They have a pole with a tennis ball hanging in a spiral type of thing. What is that? You've seen that? Tether ball, yes, right. They call it something else in Australia. So that you go on hitting it and it goes round and round and round and round. Have you ever seen someone playing that game, looking at the field or at the floor? For instance, when you play tennis, you are looking at the ground too, the field, the court. But one who is doing that, he has no time to look down. He is busy looking at how the ball is going. Where the ball is going. So, the one who is busy doing all this, he gets so deeply and thoroughly involved in it, he has no time to examine this me. You hit the ball, it seems to come down there, you have no time, you have no energy, you have no incentive to stop and think, what am I doing here? Because you are worried that ball is coming the other way, hit it there. And therefore this karma is kept going. One has neither the equipment nor the predisposition nor the motivation to sit down and what on earth is happening now. Then you will discover the me doesn't exist, and therefore as long as that this fellow is identified with this me, he has no choice. He will go on like that. And he must collapse one day and discover that this me does not exist. Then there is infinite choice. Millions of choices. That can make choices. But there is no time, there is no inclination, there is nothing. You are so busy acting, reacting, reacting, reacting all the time. The tennis player does not act at all, he reacts. Is that right? Huh? Once the ball has been served, you know, you are not acting, you are not doing anything. You are merely reacting to what the other person does. And in this constant rush of reaction, you go on committing the same thing over and over again without ever bothering to examine the total life. And in that there is absolutely no free will at all. When it comes to reaction, you have no free will. You act blindly, foolishly, or wisely, whatever it is, in strict accordance with your own mental conditioning. Whatever habit is formed, it is that habit that goes on acting. Only if that fellow playing this ball has the time to look down, contemplate, meditate, examine his life, then he might discover that there is free will, choice in this, on the level of consciousness. But he doesn't. And as long as one does not turn towards the reality, face the reality, one does not have a choice. Only when one dares to turn in and examine oneself, only then the choice is found. And it was Ramana Maharshi's view also that everyone has this much of choice. You can give up, you can stop playing the game and look within. Possible. Seeing this endlessness of this game playing, now we come back to the orthodoxy, the official doctrine. Seeing this endlessness of game playing and seeing how a reaction follows action. Action is inevitable in this world, and as long as there is action, reaction is inevitable in this world. Two imperatives they saw, they the sages and the yogis. Two imperatives they saw. Then they thought, all right, not too many people will have the time and the inclination to contemplate, to discover the non-existence of the me. So, do something. Let us do something whereby we may be able to better human life on earth for the individual as well as for the society. Now, hereafter you must severely leave all this self-realization business. Come right down to the earth. Action is inevitable. Everyone is going to do something or other constantly. And as long as there is action, there will be reaction. And that's also inevitable. Seeing these two, let us evolve a system, and no system being perfect, let us evolve a system which might help the individual to a certain extent, but definitely help society. And they did something marvelous. They tried to introduce a threefold way of life: yajna, dana, and tapas. Yajna, dana, and tapas. Yajna is sacrifice, dana is charity, and tapas is austerity. As we go along, I'll point out how they somehow become defective. Because of the non-understanding of the basic truth. The basic truth is, the me is still accepted as reality. Yes? The me is accepted as reality. And all these, yajna, dana, and tapas, sacrifice, charity, and austerity, are all performed by this false me, false ego. And therefore, anything done in the darkness of ignorance is dark, is foolish, stupid, however glorious it may be, however great it may look superficially. Let's take it from the other end. Tapas was austerity. Perhaps these sages and the yogis perceived that under the heavy influence of the me, there is love of pleasure, there is love of luxury, comfort. Love of pleasure, pursuit of pleasure. And they also saw that as long as pleasure motivates the actions of people, it became vicious. The action became vicious. Pleasure, my pleasure involves your privation. I want something and I must take it away from somebody else, somebody or other. I want to accumulate something and I must deprive you of what you need. So, pleasure almost always involves domination. And domination being oppression of some other, another, aggressiveness, cruelty. And this cruelty and the domination and so on, they come back and hit you sometime or other. Now, later, in heaven, in hell, back again in the hell known as the earth, it comes back sometime or other. And it comes back when you are weak. So they said, all right, give up this pursuit of pleasure. The word pursuit is terribly important. And I think at some time or other in our own life, we forgot that what they meant was pursuit of pleasure and therefore rejected pleasure itself as something terrible. Everywhere in these texts on which the whole doctrine is based, there is a very beautiful statement which is persistently ignored by us. The intelligence that is built into this body responds, not reacts, responds to pleasure and pain. There is a natural painful sensation, and there is a natural pleasant sensation. The sensation itself, which is in you, which is in the cat, which is in the dog, which is probably in the plants, which is probably everywhere, in all living beings. All living beings respond to pleasurable sensations, neurological. This is pure neurological sensation. It does not really involve the spirit. It's a pure neurological phenomenon. Unlike poles attract each other, magnetism. There is no love-hate relationship in the magnetic field. There is no love-hate relationship at all. But when you turn two pieces of magnet with the positive poles facing each other, they kick apart. And turn it the other way, they jump close together. There is no love, there is no hate. Love and hate are born of your own mental conditioning, psychological conditioning. These scriptures do insist that there is this inherent experience of pleasure, inherent experience of pain built into every living organism, that you need neither reject nor accept. It is there. But pursuit of pleasure, when does one pursue pleasure? When does one pursue pleasure? When the experience of pleasure leaves an impression on your mind, and the mind begins to crave for it, when the pleasure is not there. That is what they call pursuit of pleasure, or Buddha called it tanha, which is craving for pleasure. Nobody objected to pleasure. You are experiencing pleasure. It is there, in spite of you. But what was discouraged was the pursuit of pleasure. Don't let the pleasurable experience, which is always momentary, right? You chew a piece of chocolate, it's very sweet. Yeah? Enjoy it. When I say enjoy it, it is inevitable, right? You don't have to enjoy it. When you put that piece of chocolate in your mouth, it tastes sweet. That's it. Leave it alone there. After a few minutes, the saliva has sort of diluted the whole thing, finished the taste. Then, where is the chocolate? In the mind. See that it does not leave that vasana, that smell, that incense in your mind. It came, chocolate came. It went. It's gone. It's nice. I wish I could have another. That is pursuit of pleasure. If you look at these animals, no animals do that, except the domesticated ones. They enjoy when they have to enjoy, and then that's over. It's finished. And they are very busy doing something else, sleeping.
I wonder what use is the mind to us?
Oh, there's plenty of one. If mind has its own use.
Seems that animals crave too.
domesticated ones, not the wild ones. No.
Bears in the parks in summer?
Domesticated ones, trained ones. You train them. Natural animals. Even your child, baby. When I say child, not the 6-year-old. The 6-year-old is already brought up on chocolate and the peanut butter. The baby, you look at the baby. It feeds and it's over. That's it. Whether the bottle falls down, breaks into 100 pieces, it doesn't care. It's finished. So pursuit of pleasure was discouraged, and the abandonment of the pursuit of pleasure is called tapas. But then somewhere it got out of control. And people began to hate pleasure. It's a beautiful, delightful pursuit. Another pursuit. The opposite type of pursuit. Pursuit of pain. We forgot that it is the pursuit of pleasure that was our enemy. But we regarded the pleasure itself as enemy. And therefore pursued pain. Not realizing that which the mind pursues is pleasure. If it is sadism, that is pleasure. It gives pleasure. I know of at least definitely one, I think also two young women who loved their husbands to beat them. Oh, they complained. Yes, they came to me and said, "Look how he this mark. But why do you go back to him?" They laugh and go with it.